Okay, perhaps in the interest of time, we'll just move right into it. So the next speaker is Lisa Ainsworth. So this is what a Purdue person doesn't do often, is to invite two people from a competing university. And so we've asked Lisa Ainsworth to come in. So we've talked a little bit about corn, we've talked a little bit about cotton and wheat, and now we're going to shift emphasis into climate change and soybeans. So Lisa Ainsworth is the acknowledged expert in many things to do with greenhouse gases and soybeans. So here we go.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Tony, for the invitation to be here today and to talk to you about this research. And so my talk is going to have a lot of data, just to warn you now. So we're going to talk about improving soybean yields and elevated CO2. And so this is a chart that just shows you CO2 concentrations for the last 650,000 years. And you can see that they wobbled around 280 parts per million for the last 650,000 years. And today, they're 43% higher than that at 400 parts per million. So significantly higher than in recent geological times. And of course, it's this increase in CO2 concentrations and other greenhouse gases that's driving global warming. And so it's interesting, we heard earlier today that that in the Midwest U.S. over the last 30 years, there hasn't been an increase in temperature. And that's really a global anomaly. So that's true, but it's an anomaly. Across the globe, temperatures have warmed, and they've warmed by 1.1 degrees Celsius since 1900. And so this variability in temperature and precipitation and also in pest and disease pressure have challenged agriculture since there's been agriculture. But really, the changes in atmospheric composition are a new dimension to crop production that provides challenges but also significant opportunities, and that's really what I'd like to focus on today for plant breeders and also for biologists. And so I you know, hope that after this presentation you'll agree that understanding soybean responses to CO2 and the interaction in particular with other stresses is one of the keys to improving resiliency of production in the future, and that's really the focus of this session. And so I'm going to talk to you about research that we do at the Soybean Free Air CO2 Enrichment Site. This is in Champaign, Illinois, and this is an aerial view of the soy face facility. And so it's an 80-acre field, half of it's planted in corn, half of it's planted in soybean. And we have 32 plots where we can alter the atmospheric composition in which we grow our crops. And so you can see some of those plots in this aerial picture here, where these squares show you where the soy face rings are actually located. And this is just the CO2 tank for reference, and there's a grain bin there, so you can sort of see the size of this. So this is the Google Earth image of our field site. And so, as I mentioned, we do a crop rotation, corn, soy, and switch that every year. And we have 32 plots in which we can grow plants under elevated CO2 or elevated ozone or both. And the nice part about this facility is it's totally modular, so we can actually plant the crop, then come in, construct the face rings, and then before we harvest, we go in and we take the face rings down. And this is nice because that gives us flexibility in what we plant, how many varieties we plant in any given year, even how we, you know, potentially manage those varieties that we plant. So this is a close-up of one of the rings. They're 20 meters, about 60 feet in diameter. In the center of each ring, we're monitoring wind speed and wind direction and also the concentration of carbon dioxide or other gases. And so that information about wind speed and wind direction is relayed to a computer that controls the manifold that you can see right there. And then that controls the release of gas from the upwind side. And so then the CO2 flows with the wind over the plot, enriching the concentration of the gas. That's monitored in real time, so every 4 seconds we're actually collecting data. So if the wind speed and wind direction changes, then the system adjusts to release the gas. And this provides, a relatively accurate fumigation efficiency. This is data collected by Tim Meese, who was the first operator of Soyface, showing you that on this particular day, we were within 96% of our, that the 1 minute averages for 96% of the time were within 10% of our target. And then this thermal image shows you the homogeneity of the treatment. And so one of the key effects of elevated CO2, or the fundamental effects, is to decrease the model conductance, and that can reduce evaporative cooling, and that's exactly what you're seeing in this thermal image. And so, soybean as a C3 crop has two direct physiological responses to rising CO2. The first is an increase in photosynthetic rate, and this is due to the fact that Rubisco is both a carboxylase and an oxygenase. So if you increase CO2 concentrations, you reduce that competing oxygenation reaction, subsequent photorespiration, and so you get an increase in photosynthesis. The second is the decrease in conductance that I just mentioned. And so an increase in photosynthesis leads to an increase in carbohydrate production in the leaves. It also increases sugar metabolism and respiration in plants. And ultimately, it increases the biomass productivity of most C3 crops when they're grown at elevated CO2. And so this is just a figure from a study that Pat Morgan led quite a few years ago now, but showing you that biomass increases in soybean grown at elevated CO2. And so what we're interested in my lab is what's the variation in this response? And in particular, what's the variation in the yield response? And so this is an analysis that was led by Kristen Bishop, who's a graduate student in my group. And what's shown here are 18 different varieties in their response over a couple of years to elevated CO2. And so what you can see is that there are some varieties that essentially don't improve their yields at all when they're grown in elevated CO2, and others that show about a 20% stimulation in yields when they're grown at elevated CO2. And so this study was done at a CO2 concentration of about 550 parts per million, which is what we anticipate for the year 2050. So if we look at this yield in a little more detail, biomass in nearly all of the lines increased by elevated CO2, and it increased more than the seed yield response did. So these genotypes are ordered in the same way as the previous slide, so the two lines that showed the least response also didn't show a significant biomass response, but everything else did. And on average, the biomass response was about a 25% increase at elevated CO2. Harvest index, on the other hand, was decreased. It was consistently lower in elevated CO2 by about 10%. And so what we were curious about is what's the physiological basis for this variation in yield response to elevated CO2. So if we take two lines, for example, HS93-4118, it was released in the year 2000. It's a maturity group 2 line, and it basically shows no response of yield to elevated CO2. And we can contrast that with a line like LOTA, also released in the year 2000, also maturity group 2, but it shows a 20% decrease or increase in yield at elevated CO2. And so we were interested in whether we could figure out the physiological reasons for this or why. And so in order to do this, we sort of thought about yield in terms of the yield equation that was adapted from Monteith. And we can break up yield into a series of efficiencies, the efficiency of light interception of the two lines, the efficiency of conversion efficiency, so basically taking that energy that's intercepted and turning it into carbon, and then partitioning, so putting that carbon into the seeds where we harvested at the end of the year. And so how do these efficiencies respond to CO2 in these two very different lines? And so I'm showing you some data that was collected by primarily by David Rosenthal, who's now at Ohio University, and also Alvaro Sanz, a former postdoc in my lab. And so over 3 years, we measured leaf area index, for example, and the open symbols here are ambient CO2, the blue symbols are elevated CO2, the circles are HS93, that's the line that didn't respond to high CO2, and the triangles are LOTA, that's our responsive cultivar. And so in 2012 and in 2014, peak leaf area index was actually higher in elevated CO2 in both lines, both HS93 and LOTA. And there was a significant cultivar interaction in 2012 where the increase, the stimulation in leaf area index was greater in LOTA, our responsive line, than in HS93, but that wasn't consistent across the 3 years of study. And so if we then look at interception efficiency, so just looking at the light interception by the canopy, what we saw was, and so this is going through the growing season, again, HS is in circles, LOTA is in triangles. HS, which is our cultivar that's not responding in terms of its yield to CO2, does close its canopy a little earlier than LOTA, so there's contrasting sort of canopy closure responses there. And there is a CO2 effect that's significant, so both lines tend to close their canopy a little faster in elevated CO2. If we look at the mean interception efficiency over the growing season, HS has a significantly greater interception efficiency, in part due to that more rapid canopy closure and in part due to a slightly longer growing season, but it doesn't show a CO2 response, whereas LODA does show, when you do the pairwise comparison, a small but statistically significant increase in interception efficiency at elevated CO2. So then we looked at components that contribute to conversion efficiency in these two contrasting lines. This is just showing you daily photosynthetic carbon gain that we measured at different times in the growing season across 3 years. In here, elevated CO2 consistently increased photosynthesis and daily carbon gain in both lines, but there was no cultivar by CO2 interaction. And when we looked at respiration, really very little was happening. In some stages, LODA had higher respiration rates than HS, and there was sort of a hint that high CO2 might increase respiration rates, but really there wasn't anything that was consistent across the growing season. And so when we plotted out conversion efficiency of these two lines, which is just looking at the energy content of the biomass versus the light intercepted, what we found was that conversion efficiency was significantly greater in LODA than in HS, and so we had a significant variety effect there. And although there was no variety by CO2 interaction, the relative stimulation and conversion efficiency was double in LODA, which is our yield-responsive cultivar, than in HS93 for 118. And so finally, we looked at above-ground biomass and harvest index in these two lines. For the total above-ground biomass at the end of the season, the 2 years were different. So in 2013, we saw a CO2 effect that we couldn't statistically resolve that in 2014. But in 2014, LODA was actually bigger than HS93. The harvest index results also weren't statistically significant in our 2 years, but the trend was that CO2 decreased harvest index, which is what we saw across our 18 genotype panel. And in 2014, LODA had slightly higher harvest index than HS93. So this is showing you now the seed yield response of these two lines and the response to elevated CO2 across 8 growing seasons. And so we'll just concentrate on the average of these two growing seasons here at the end. And so the seed yield response in HS93 was a 9% increase, not statistically significant, across these 8 years of study, where there was a 24% increase in seed yield in LODA. And if we look at this in terms of the efficiencies that are determining this yield, so a 9% increase in HS93, a 24% increase in LODA, all of the efficiencies contributed to a better response in LODA than HS93. So it had a greater response to CO2 in terms of its interception efficiency, a greater response to CO2 in terms of its conversion efficiency, and it wasn't penalized quite as much in terms of the harvest index at elevated CO2 compared to HS93. And so just some conclusions from this part of the talk. There's genetic variability in soybean cultivar yield responses to high CO2. And certainly in our studies, LODA was more responsive to HS93, mostly due to greater conversion efficiency, but also the other efficiencies as well. And so I think this is a nice study showing you the potential for farmers, really, in choosing their lines. So what's interesting, I think, about LODA and HS93 is if you look at their yields in ambient CO2, so this is the white bar and the gray bar there, they're almost identical. These are two lines that basically have yields that are the same at ambient CO2, but very, very different yields at elevated CO2. And so if you're a farmer choosing lines in the future, this represents a significant loss of profit by choosing the wrong line. And so, we just looked at sort of the physiological basis from that very broadly. But what one could do is screen for the CO2 response in recombinant inbred population to really identify markers that are linked to that CO2 response. And that could help with strategies to breed for CO2 responsiveness in the future. But of course, CO2 isn't increasing in the atmosphere in isolation. There's other changes in climate that are also occurring. And so CO2 will interact with temperature, and it'll also interact with water availability. And so at Soyface, there have been experiments using infrared heaters that Carl Bernacki and Don Ort have led, where they've increased the temperature of the canopy by up to 3.5 degrees for the whole growing season. And there have also been experiments looking at the interaction with drought. And this is work that's been led by Andrew Leakey, where he used awnings that came out at night to intercept rainfall. And so in this way, he intercepted between 60 and 79% of summer rainfall that fell during the night. And so I'd like to just talk a little bit about the CO2 by drought interaction now. And so if we go back to sort of the expected response of soybean to elevated CO2, there's a big increase in photosynthesis with elevated CO2 because of this reduction in photorespiration. And that should lead to an improvement in crop yields. And while I showed you genetic variation in that response, on average, the genotypes did have higher yields at elevated CO2. The second physiological response is that they reduce stomatal conductance, and so that can reduce canopy transpiration, and so that leads to this warming that we can see using infrared images. That should also mean that there's greater evapotranspiration at ambient CO2 than elevated CO2. And that should improve soil moisture. And so that's and that is true under some cases. So we can measure where there's greater soil moisture, and it's up to 30% enhanced at elevated CO2 in soybean that we've measured at our field site. And so that, again, should greatly increase crop yields under droughted conditions. And so the paradigm, or the overarching hypothesis, is that the benefit of elevated CO2 will be greater than drought stress. And so this is just showing you what we would predict. If this is mean daily precipitation minus potential evapotranspiration, our yield response should be greater under dry conditions and less under well-watered conditions. But if we look across the soybean genotypes that we've grown out there, we see, in fact, the opposite. So across 7 genotypes, the magnitude of the yield stimulation decreased as drought stress became stronger. And so this was puzzling, and so Andrew Leakey's group did a lot of work to figure out why. And so what I'm showing you here is just sort of a map of the effects of elevated CO2 on soil moisture. And so if you'll just bear with me, soil volumetric water content is on the axis here, and soil depth is here. So as you look into the page, you're going deeper into the soil. And so that's why water content is more stable the deeper you go in the soil. And this is through the growing season. So day of year is plotted here. So what you can see is basically you get dry down periods and then a water event, and so then moisture goes back up. This is sort of a long drought condition, so moisture goes down, a rain event, and goes back up. And then what's plotted in the color is the percent change in moisture at elevated CO2. So 2004 is a nice year. It behaves the way that we would theoretically predict, where you're getting up to 20% greater soil moisture under dry down conditions at elevated CO2. So now we'll take 2004, and look at it in the context of a number of 7 other years. And so what you can see is years like 2004, you get an improvement in moisture content at elevated CO2, and that's true in 2005 and 2007 to some extent. But there are years like 2010 and 2011 where, in fact, you get less moisture available at elevated CO2. And why might that be? And so if we look at the sort of distribution of data here, this is the effect of elevated CO2 on soil moisture versus precipitation versus air temperature. We see this, where under conditions that are favorable, so high precipitation, lower temperature, elevated CO2 makes soils wetter. Under very unfavorable conditions, elevated CO2 makes conditions drier. And one of the reasons for that, if we go back to this condition, is if we take 2010, for example, this was a year where there was ample soil moisture early in the season, so under elevated CO2, the crops were bigger, they developed a bigger canopy, and they were able to draw down moisture even more. So then when it didn't rain and we had a very long dry down period, what happened was these plants grown in elevated CO2 actually used more moisture and used up those soil reserves. And in years like that, we don't get a yield response to elevated CO2. And so it's a complex interaction, but what it results in is that The yield stimulation by high CO2 declined as drought stress strengthened, and elevated CO2 didn't lead to greater soil moisture when it was most needed by the crop. And so it's these effects on canopy size and temperature that influence total canopy water use more than previously observed. And so just some final conclusions. The increase in CO2 is uniform, it's global, and it's also committed. So I'd argue that attempts to engineer crops to perform better under increasing environmental stress need to do this against a backdrop of this rising CO2. But certainly we need a better understanding of these unexpected interactions between rising CO2 and other abiotic and biotic factors in order to optimize our future productivity. So with that, I'll just thank my co-authors and the funding, and thank you for your attention.
Sorry, Lisa.
That's okay.
You felt crowded there by my encouraging you to finish up quickly. So, questions for Lisa.
You showed the difference in two cold spots. Differences in conversion efficiency. Do you have any idea what in conversion efficiency is?
Yeah, no, because when we measured photosynthesis, it wasn't photosynthesis. If you measured sort of diurnal photosynthesis in a leaf at the top of the canopy, it wasn't that, and it wasn't respiration. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, we don't know yet. And so I think there, you know, doing sort of the physiological approaches that are relatively easy to do with a good team of people who are willing to go out there and do it, aren't really getting at the answer. So there, I think taking a genetic approach could be really useful.
If you happen to measure flora, abortion, pod numbers, or anything that would give you some idea of what harvest index would be?
No, we haven't looked at that.
Okay.
Not in the science, yeah. And it's not just inferring it. We've also put rhizotrons below ground, and by we, I mean Andrew Leakey, and looked at rooting depth and root distribution, and so you do get more roots under elevated CO2. Ironically, under conditions where they're very droughted, the majority of those roots are in dry soil, which again would have a negative feedback on nitrogen fixation in soybean, and it also leads to this sort of inversion in CO2 response that we see.
Question over there. Have you considered measuring photosynthetic rates across the canopy on the plant instead of taking one rate from the top leaf on the plant to look at the conversion efficiency?
Yeah, and so we didn't actually use any of the photosynthesis data to get conversion efficiency. For that, we used actual biomass harvest throughout the season, and then the interception efficiency to estimate conversion efficiency. But we have looked throughout the canopy as well, and and that also doesn't really tell us, you know, anything that's informative about the difference between these two lines. So we're measuring it at the conditions that on the different days of the growing season, we go out and measure the conditions during the day. So ambient light, ambient temperature. Yeah, and as close as possible as matching the VPD. But yeah. Sounds more fun over there. Yeah, so we have looked at protein and oil in soybean, and in we don't see many differences in elevated CO2. And so this is quite different to many of the cereals that have been looked at, where there's a significant decline in protein content in elevated CO2. Soybeans are nitrogen fixers, though, and so they're better able to maintain nitrogen in the seeds.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it depends on the nature of your question and what you're trying to do or trying to model. I mean, I don't think we throw everything that we've ever learned out. And I don't think that that's any different from what people would have said 30 years ago. I mean, I think in terms of modeling, I think that the limitations of taking one genotype and then applying that to a global model of production and food supply have always been recognized. And I don't think that this data necessarily changes our worldview on that. But, you know, what I'm hoping is that this can get us thinking, you know, towards we can actually use this variation to our advantage, right? And so we can start to really think about breeding and identifying lines that we could use in the future for breeding for CO2 response. But I think there's always been an acknowledgement that varieties will differ.
Compete with the neighbors next door. As agronomists, always need to compete for funding, for recognition, and sometimes to put food on the table. Okay, so here we are. We've got Christopher Kucharik from, I may not have pronounced that name exactly right, but he was just produced some outstanding papers several years ago, which sort of was ahead of the curve in the sense of looking at the impact of technology changes on corn yield increases over the years. And it was those papers that kind of prompted me to ask an ecologist to address this group of eminent agronomists. So thank you, Christopher.